We'll move to the fifth case, which is United States versus Errol Gilliam. Gilliam. Berman.
May it please the court, I'm Morris Berman, and I represented Darrell Gilliam on appointment in the district court in two trials and represent him on this appeal. We had two trials in the Western District, one in June and one in July of last year, and at the end of the second trial, first one ended in a mistrial. At the end of the second trial, Mr. Gilliam was convicted of being a felon in possession of a firearm and ammunition in violation of 922G. At sentencing, it was a two-phase sentencing, and on October 23rd of last year, he was found to be an armed career criminal and accordingly sentenced to 188 months, which was the bottom of his guideline range, but he was subject to the mandatory minimum 15 years because of the armed career criminal status, which of course increased his maximum to life, made the mandatory minimum 15 instead of the statutory maximum of 10 years to which he would have otherwise been subjected. We raised issues relating to the forcible entry of the apartment for the search warrant, and we raised issues regarding the prosecution's non-disclosure of what we contend to be exculpatory evidence. And we also raised issues regarding to the finding of the armed career criminal status. And in terms of going sort of to the end of the chronology, I want to address some of the issues related to the finding of the armed career criminal status. Because what's at issue there was a set of Illinois convictions from back in the early 80s from which Mr. Gilliam was paroled and discharged in October of 1983. And at the time he was discharged, Illinois issued, and it's attached to the supplementary appendix to the government's brief, issued the order for discharge issued by the state of Illinois under the imprimatur of then Governor James Thompson, who said that I, Governor James Thompson, do hereby approve this order, commute the sentence. Delivery of this document relieves you of all sentence obligations as described herein. Your right to vote and administer estates are regained, though you may be required to show this document to the registration authority. Of course, this became terribly pertinent to the sentencing of Mr. Gilliam because of the effect of 921A20 of 18 U.S. Code, which provides that where a person has been pardoned or had civil rights restored, that prior conviction shall not be considered a conviction for purposes of this chapter unless such restoration of civil rights expressly provides that the person may not possess firearms. This discharge didn't have that express provision. And so then we get into the effect of the line of cases, starting with Irwin, but I submit more pertinent, Glazer, United States versus Glazer out of the Western District, decided by this court, and Dollar versus United States, which provide that the certificate of discharge must specifically provide, unambiguously provide, and tell the person that he may not possess firearms to be a countable conviction under 18 United States Code 921A20.
You mean it's assumed he has all of these rights unless they're specifically denied?
Well, what the government is contending, I believe, is that you have to read the last sentence of this discharge as delimiting the rights which are restored. And as I think I indicated in my reply brief, by that reading, which we contend is overly constrained, the only rights he would have restored would be to vote, presumably work for his Chicago alderman, and probate estate. The fact is that it doesn't expressly provide that he may not possess firearms. Now, in that connection, I think the case of United States versus Glazer is an important one, because in that case, the discharge issued by Minnesota actually expressly told Mr. Glazer, note, your disabilities under the Federal Firearms Act, those disabilities are still in effect. It doesn't do away with them. And in the Glazer opinion, this circuit said that's not good enough. And that's addressed again in Dollar. We held in Glazer, this is from Dollar, that ambiguous reference to the Federal Gun Control Act could not take the place of an express reference to state firearms disabilities.
What other civil rights would be presumed that were not listed?
Well, presumably there'd be licensing rights. Presumably there would be rights to serve on a jury. Presumably there might be other licensing rights which would otherwise be constrained. We're not contending.
Well, I mean, wait. There were two, I guess, that were specifically mentioned. That
right.
You can vote and.
You can vote
administer
and you
a state.
Can administer a state.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, what other civil rights were not mentioned that you would presume would be restored by that sort of blanket?
Well, that's. I think that's just the point that it is blanket. But I think, for example, to vote. To serve, well, that's in the discharge, to serve on a jury, for example.
Okay, is that a given?
Is it a given?
Yeah.
Under Illinois law?
Well, no, under this situation where you mentioned two things, I'm curious, I don't know how many civil rights actually exist under this, that we all take for granted. And two, it seemed necessary to mention two. One of which, right to vote, which is good, but right to administer a state seems rather arcane.
It does seem arcane.
But then I don't know whether there are a list of 10 other things that are normally denied to convicted felons.
And I presume that there are. And I don't think it's so important necessarily under the cases what those rights necessarily are. The case is focused on, does the discharge unambiguously tell the person that he may not possess a firearm? Whether he may or may not is not really the question. It's whether he may. And to the extent that this is ambiguous, I contend that the ambiguity inures in favor of Mr. Gillum in this case. The Irwin case talked about when the state delivers a piece of paper implying that civil rights have been restored. It's not actually that this civil right was restored. Actually, at the time, it was sort of in limbo. But that's not significant.
You're into your rebuttal.
I am.
Just so
so unless you have some questions, I'll reserve the balance of the time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning. My name is Tim O'Shea. I represent the United States in this case.
Why don't you tell us why we shouldn't construe this ambiguity in favor of the appellant?
First of all, I mean, I don't think anyone who receives the piece of paper, the order for discharge, that's in the supplemental appendix of the United States would view this, the right to vote and to administer estates, and say that is a green light for me to go get a gun. The question is not whether, from the statutory question, is not whether the effect of the federal law is that one civil right restores all civil rights. The question that other things, the right to cut hair or to run for public office and so on, are somehow restored just because the state restores one civil right after conviction. Rather, the question is whether under this particular statute, 922A20, whether for federal law purposes, at least if this particular federal law works, the felon in possession of a firearm, whether that would be counted as a felony for felon in possession purposes.
Right, and the language says any conviction which has been expunged, et cetera, or has had civil rights restored, does not say has had all civil rights restored. It says has had civil rights restored.
Right.
He's had some of his civil rights restored.
Right. The district court here Dollar could be read to say, and I think the fair reading of Dollar probably is, that if one civil right is restored, then one is not a felon for federal purposes. Irwin, I respectfully submit, sort of cuts the other way, and there's a critical fact here as well. I respectfully submit that Irwin cuts the other way to a degree, and the district court properly reconciled these to say that this is an illogical interpretation to say that one civil right, any civil right, to be a barber and cut hair, or to vote, or to administrate a state, means that one, under federal law, can possess a weapon, that one is no longer a felon. I think that was a reasonable interpretation of the district court in light of Irwin and Dollar. Now, I think
and
that...
Of course, Dollar is the later case.
That's correct. And as Judge Crabb ruled, she said, look, Dollar, however, did not overrule Irwin, so I have to try to reconcile these, and this is how I reconcile them. And I respectfully suggest that the district court correctly did reconcile them. And as the Irwin court noted, that this statute was designed to track state law. And under Wisconsin and Illinois law, it was unambiguous that Mr. Gillum was not permitted to possess firearms, that he was a felon. And this is the other point I wanted to make about this. As in the Irwin case, here, in this case, there is zero evidence in the record that Mr. Gillum had received, that he'd read, or relied upon that piece of paper, that is the order for discharge, that has restored his right to vote and administer estates. It appears that that's a copy that has been printed off of microfiche, and that's my understanding of where it came from. There's no evidence that Mr. Gillum relied on that.
And in Irwin and Dollar, was there any discussion of reliance of the individuals?
In Irwin.
What about Dollar?
In Dollar, I believe Dollar actually got a piece of paper, that he physically received a piece of paper. And in Dollar, they were, as I recall, they were broader civil rights restored, that it was more along the lines of, hey, your civil rights are restored. So I would respectfully submit, that with all due respect to this court generally, to Judge Easterbrook, who wrote these decisions, that the train of thought in Dollar, that if one civil right is restored to vote or to cut hair as a barber and be licensed and all the rest is restored, that it necessarily follows that one is not a felon under federal law, it should be reconsidered. I respectfully submit that it necessarily...
Reconsidered, it would have to say all civil rights, or
no,
some?
It would have to be the person... This is concerned about a mousetrapping thing. This some poor person is going to get a piece of paper and think, I've been, you know, I'm restored, I'm A-okay, I can get a gun, and then snap... They're caught and then jettisoned as Mr. Gillum is for a rather long period of time.
Well, I guess when you back off and look at this case, the search warrant with the battering ram wasn't to look for a gun.
No, it was to look for drugs.
Yeah, and didn't find any, so all he found was a gun.
That's correct.
So that's where the tail sort of wags the dog here, and you really want to make sure it's correct.
Right. If I could use that, and unless there are any other questions on this point, I would like to bring up one point about the motion for a new trial and the whole thing about Mr. Hetherly and his burglary. I would respectfully submit that...
Well, I'm still back on the 921-820 because you think it's time for Irwin to be overruled, and I don't think you've made a compelling case for that. And why should we, when it's unclear, the statute is unclear when it says has had civil rights restored, why should we interpret that favorably toward the state rather than toward a felon?
The reason I would submit to the court is the interpretation, not so much of Irwin, but of Dollar, would necessarily conflict with state laws. Unambiguously, Mr. Gillum is not permitted to have a firearm under Illinois state law or under Wisconsin. You know, he has been convicted of a felony. Now, then the question is...
And at some point, was he advised of that, other than this piece of paper that his rights, certain rights were restored?
No, I don't believe anyone from the state of Wisconsin or state of
told
Illinois
him he
said,
could not
hey,
carry
we
his
still
gun.
Think you're a felon.
In a matter well, of or at some point when he was released, was he told, you cannot carry a gun? Did the state ever?
No. Well,
was he told that as part of his release documents, in addition to receiving this document that restored certain rights?
No. Is Mr.
So what? So prisoners just kind of know this when it's time for them to get released that they can't carry a gun. I mean, how does the state convey that so people know?
Well, the state does not have to convey that to folks. First, as the court calls from the trial court days, is the elements of felon possession of a firearm. One does not need to know, one cannot have a firearm. One only needs to know that one actually possesses a firearm, and it's
right. But I'm talking in the context of this armed career criminal, because that really changed. I mean, I understand that generally speaking, but for our current armed career criminal purposes, when one can be sentenced for up to life in prison, I'm just wondering whether the state does that.
The state does not, as far as I know, tell a person that, and I think we have to refer to ignorance of the law as no excuse. But my broader point it would be, Your Honor, that that this court should interpret federal laws is not necessarily conflicting with state laws. And that is, Mr. Gillum unambiguously was not permitted to have it. And I don't think that the reference to civil rights, that it necessarily or logically follows that even a restoration of one civil right, completely unrelated to, in this case, completely unrelated to a person's possession of weapons, firearms, should necessarily mean that for federal purposes, the person is not a felon. So
I understand your point.
Okay. I just wanted to note one quick thing about the Hesterly burglary. I just wanted to note that and this relates to the defendant's motion for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence or Brady evidence. The test and that sort of collapsed into one because if it's favorable for the defense, it's required to be as necessarily Brady-type material as well. But Mr. Hesterly's burglary story is chronologically inconsistent with the facts, and I'm not sure this is adequately spelled out in the briefs, and thus is neither favorable to the defense or material in the sense that it could have changed the outcome of trial. Mr. Hesterly told the police that his home was burglarized on December 1, 2001. Okay? That is the day after, in that this Breitko 38 caliber firearm was stolen, and he thinks this man named Stinson may have been the person to take it. It is one day after the search warrant was executed at the defendant's home on November 30, 2001. Moreover, Mr. Hesterly is saying it was stolen on the day after this gun was found in the defendant's home. Moreover, the defendant and his children said that they saw this firearm in the apartment a couple days earlier than the police executed the search warrant on the 27th or 28th of November. So because Mr. Hesterly's story of this alleged burglary is chronologically inconsistent with the known fact, it would not have affected the outcome of the trial, and it was not favorable to the defense. I see that my time is up. I thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Berman, you've got 2 minutes.
Thank you. Well, I'll be real quick, and let me move to the second issue first as to the chronology of the theft of the gun by Stinson from Mr. Hesterly's apartment. And I'm sure the government is inadvertent in its mistake in the record here. The search warrant was issued on November 30th, 2001. The search warrant was executed on December 4, 2001. Therefore, a burglary on or about December 1 certainly could have led to that gun being in Mr. Gillum's apartment being sold by Stinson to this Rashawn Ross. And I direct the court's attention to my supplementary appendix at supplementary appendix page 9, which is the report and recommendation of the magistrate judge, which goes through the facts of that forcible entry and search warrant. Secondly, as to the green light, before I get the red light, as to the green light, it's not a matter of the felon's state of mind, and I respectfully suggest that the government's doing here is mixing the analysis between whether one is guilty under 922G and whether he is a armed career criminal under 924 and the application of 921A. And Dollar speaks specifically about that, because Judge Easterbrook writes about Dollar saying it isn't that Dollar thought he had a green light, to use the government's paraphrase here, it's that he decided to flout the law. Well, that's the question of whether someone's culpable under 922G. The question here is whether the conviction is a countable one for finding armed career criminal status. Critical question with respect to Mr. Gillum, because as I read his guideline range, I think it was 97 to 121 months, absent the armed career criminal status, instead of 15 years plus. Now, as to the argument that there's no evidence that this was received, this was not an argument made by the government in the lower court. It wasn't considered by the district court in terms of making its decision as to whether it was a countable conviction. I think it was just assumed, well, actually the judge's analysis just went on her belief that this was not conveying to Mr. Gillum that he had or could possibly have that civil right restored as to possession of a firearm. Unless the court has any further questions, I see my time's up. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Case will be taken under advisement. I understand you